Good morning, Trinity Covenant. I'm Dave, one of the pastors at High Rock, and I'm eager to dive into this passage together. You know, sometimes life doesn't seem fair. Have any of you ever experienced that? Of course you have. Everybody has. The year before I graduated from seminary, someone I knew from another, clearly inferior seminary graduated. And though he had almost no pastoral experience, and it was much less than I had at that point, a friend on his seminary's faculty set him up with a cushy job at a prestigious local church. Good for him, right? Well, that wasn't my reaction. I was indignant. Yes, that guy was intelligent and diligent and godly and would probably do a fine job. But let's face it, in my entirely objective opinion, he wasn't nearly as intelligent or diligent as I was. Oh, godly, I wasn't so sure, and maybe he had me there, but in any case, I was sure that he wouldn't do as good a job as I would if I were given that job. Mind you, I had a year left before graduating, so I wasn't even looking for a job. But the fact that this guy got the job that I thought I deserved more than he did made me angry. It wasn't fair. How come no one's setting me up for a cushy position? Don't God and other people see how good I could be? Or recognize the hard work and good fruit I've already produced? In my bitterness, I decided to attend his first service, ostensibly to support him. But really, I was hoping to see him fail. And I did. He was so nervous that he kept pacing back and forth and literally biting his sleeves and losing his place. It was so awkward. I loved it. Now, obviously, you see the irony in this. I was clearly sinning because I thought I deserved to lead people in the way of Jesus more than he did. But at least in this area, I wasn't walking in the way of Jesus myself. But somehow, I didn't recognize that irony in the moment. Why not? Because I was blinded by envy. Envy is known as one of the deadly sins because it can deaden our souls by robbing us of joy, suffocating our gratitude for what God's given us, and hardening our hearts towards God. As if that weren't awful enough, it can also lead us into countless other sins, including gossip, backbiting, bitterness, or something even worse, so that we can settle the score. You know, it's only fair! The season of Lent began this week. Lent is a 40-day period that Christians have set aside since the earliest centuries in order to prepare themselves spiritually for the forgiveness and joy of Easter. Part of the way we prepare is by reflecting on some of the sins that have slowly taken hold in our lives, repenting and refusing to make space for those any longer. Christians often fast from something like meat, shopping, or sweets as a way of practicing self-denial and strengthening their spiritual muscles to resist the most sinister temptations we all face. So this Lent, our pastors identified 7 habits that are harming us. Most of us didn't choose those habits intentionally. None of us chooses to, you know, comparison or distraction, overwhelming busyness or despair. We just learn them along the way because that's what everybody else seems to do. We think it's normal. But that way of living can lead us to become people we don't like very much, or people who are missing out on the love and full life Jesus came to give us. Lent can be called a school for unlearning. So this year, we're inviting you to unlearn some of those familiar habits that are harming us, and in their place, embrace some new habits that might heal us instead. And today, I'm beginning this series by talking about our habit of comparing ourselves to others, which is what the parable we read is really about. A parable is a story Jesus told to make a spiritual point. And like most parables, the story is pretty simple. some migrant workers are sitting around hoping to be hired for the day so they can feed their families. Any of you from agricultural parts of our country will recognize the groups of men hanging around waiting for day labor. It was just like that. And in that era, unemployment and poverty were both rampant, so many people longed for work. Well, a group of these guys got lucky when a local landowner picked them up to work in his vineyard. He agreed to pay them a denarius, which was the going rate for a full day's labor, 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. These guys must have been thrilled. Dinner for the whole family tonight, and off they go to work. Now, let's not allow there to be any confusion. These guys are paid well, but it's hard work. They're out under the blazing sun, picking grapes, loading baskets, and hauling them to the large bins at the end of the field. Despite all our belly aching about our long hours, the typical workday then was 11 hours, 6 days a week, with no time to surf social media when the boss isn't looking or take a leisurely lunch hour. So they welcomed the work and the wages, but these guys had a long, hard, hot day ahead of them. Then, four more times later in the day, at 9 a.m., noon, 3, and 5 p.m., the landowner passes back by that same corner where there were men waiting for work. No doubt, growing increasingly desperate and hopeless about their chances of making anything that day. But each time the landowner hires a few more laborers, never specifying exactly what he'll pay them, but promising to do what's right. The first group has got to be sweaty and worn out by now, but they persevere until the day is done. We can imagine that they're feeling the sting of the sweat in their eyes and the sunburn on their backs. The bugs that come out at dusk are swarming all around them, attracted by that sweet smell of perspiration that insects love. The newer recruits working next to them, smelling fresh and looking good, their day has been relatively easy. I mean, they missed the hottest part of it. But you can imagine those early men are comforted knowing that at the end of the shift, there's a fine reward in store, a denarius. No rice-a-roni for dinner tonight. My family's having steaks on the grill, or whatever they liked back then, camel kebabs or something. Anyway, at the end of the day, 6 p.m., all the workers line up to receive their wages in the order that they arrived. Newest guys first, and the original crew in the rear. But then the guys in the back notice that the workers who've only been there an hour got paid a whole denarius. Those guys were glad to get anything. But in the end, they received everything. What a gift! A denarius! Meanwhile, the guys in back must be whispering excitedly, "This landowner's more than generous. He's just nuts. Can you imagine what he's going to pay us who've been working all day?" These guys are probably thinking, what would be great with my steak tonight? How about a vintage wine? I think the year 12 was a good year. Maybe I'll pick one of those up at the convenience tent on the way home. When this early batch of tired, dirty, sweaty laborers finally get their turn, they hold out their arms with eager anticipation as the landowner drops a coin into their hands. And what is it? One stinking, cheapo denarius. I've been out there busting my rump all day in those fields, lifting baskets and enduring the heat, and all you're giving me is one denarius? Funny, because a denarius had seemed pretty great when it was first offered. But how can you possibly pay me the same thing you paid those lazy tails who probably rolled out of bed late and didn't start work until 5? This is outrageous! A denarius isn't enough anymore. Can you imagine their frustration, their fury? Sure we can. It's the same frustration I felt as I listened to that new pastor preach for the first time. It's the same fury you may feel when your colleague or classmate gets a better raise or grade than you did, or a compliment from the boss or teacher for a project that you didn't think was done all that well. It's the silent resentment some singles feel when yet another friend gets engaged. It's the disdain for the girl who's getting too much attention because she's pretty or skinny or curvy or flirty or whatever she is. Can't they see how superficial she is? It's our envy of our friend who is so witty, smart, and seems good at everything. She expertly plays the cello in her impeccably stylish outfit while waiting for her fancy dessert to bake in the oven after she gets home from her high-powered job where she's admired and makes lots of money. She's amazing. I hate her. It's the injustice Michelle and I felt 2 decades ago when we were unable to get pregnant after trying for several years, while other couples seemed to look at each other the wrong way, and just like that, suddenly she's beginning to show. They had no appreciation for the gift a child is. And why can't God see how much better parents we would be? All of this anger, sadness, and bitterness is the result of comparison. Rather than embracing the life God gave me, the body God gave me, the family, personality, calling, and gifts that God gave me, I see the life, body, family, personality, calling, and gifts that God gave someone else and decide that mine isn't so great anymore. In the next couple of months, I'll turn 50 years old, an age when our strength and stamina gradually decline. But I'm thankful to be as healthy as I am today. I have plenty of energy for my family and job. I can play sports with my kids without much pain. Pretty good for a middle-aged man with asthma and a broken back. Thank you, God. I feel very grateful for that. Until I go to the gym, where I see the 30-year-old with bulging biceps and chiseled abs lifting what I can't anymore. And suddenly my little love handles don't seem so lovely. I'm flabby and old. Nothing changed, except my standard. Instead of being grateful for the health I have, I started comparing myself to others, and my thankfulness dropped dead. Today, I have a great job. I'm so thankful for this church. But there have been so many times along the way when I've looked at far more famous pastors like Tim Keller or Andy Stanley and envied their incredible gifts. And why can't I preach like that? Why can't I be that funny or insightful and wise? Nothing changed except my standard. Instead of being grateful for the gifts and amazing opportunities I have, I started comparing myself to others and my thankfulness died. James warns that where you have envy and selfish ambition, there you find disorder and every evil practice. The Ten Commandments and almost every book in the New Testament give explicit warnings about the deadly effects of envy. We tend to dismiss it as no big deal, but the Bible insists that it will kill you if you're not careful. So what is envy? It's not admiration. That can be good. Envy is saying, I like what you've got, but I don't like the fact that you have it. St. Augustine defined envy as sorrow over other men's good fortune and joy over other men's misfortune. Haven't you done that? Feel a tinge of happiness when your coworker's productivity falls below yours or your classmate gets a grade that isn't as good? Conversely, we get sad when someone else is invited to a party that we weren't, even if we never actually wanted to go. We just wanted to be wanted more than others are. And yet often, what we're comparing ourselves to isn't even real. Decades ago, political scientists coined the phrase the Dallas and Dynasty effect to explain revolutions around the world. Dallas and Dynasty were two popular TV shows about some fictitious American 0.1%ers. You know, Americans were jealous enough of their exaggerated opulence and attractiveness, but as this show was syndicated around the globe, revolutions followed, because when people who had been content with their simple lives for centuries saw what everyone in America was supposedly like, suddenly what they had didn't seem so great anymore. Nothing had changed, except their expectations. If that's how Americans live, then we deserve to live that way too. Our reality is no longer tolerable. The technical term for this is perceived relative deprivation. It wasn't real, but for many people, it led to bitterness, resentment, and even death. Today, we experience that in microdoses every day as we scroll aimlessly on social media through the carefully curated posts of our friends. We see their fancy night out, but not the next six nights eating leftovers and cereal while watching YouTube alone. Yeah, you see, I don't have a photo for that because no one bothers to post it, even though that's probably a much more accurate picture of our real lives. We see the beautifully framed proposal photo, but not the fight they had 30 minutes later. You know, I love how she looks so surprised in this shot, even though we know it was probably the 10th take as they were trying to get the framing and lighting just right. Okay, now try to look really surprised again. We see the gorgeous new baby with its smiling parents, but not the screaming and tears from mom an hour earlier or from the baby for the next 8 weeks, which just won't stop. We see the perfect beach shots from my friend's tropical vacation, but not the fact that Dad was drinking most of the time because he's uncomfortable trying to relate to his kids. We see the shiny new car my friend just bought, but there's no photo showing the anxiety that caused over the next 2 years as they felt overburdened by the payments. From where I sit, those people's lives look much better than mine. At the same time, social media has made us more vulnerable to advertisers. The average American sees about 4,000 ads per day telling us what we could have or should be. Advertising is designed to monetize my insecurity by manipulating my FOMO, my fear of missing out. It does this by insisting that what I have or am is not enough. They inspire discontentment to convince me to buy whatever they're selling. No wonder many studies confirm that social media use fuels depression. We start to feel terrible about ourselves as we're constantly comparing ourselves to everyone else and being told that we're not good enough. Envy and comparison destroy our joy. But usually we're only seeing part of the story. So it should come as no surprise that when we compare the best moments of their lives to the blah moments of ours, our otherwise wonderful lives suddenly seem pretty bland in comparison. It turns out that old saw about the grass always seeming greener on the other side of the fence is scientifically true. It does look greener. Because when you look straight down at the grass where you're standing, you see all the dirt and gaps between the blades. But when you look over the fence at your neighbor's yard, you're seeing the grass blades from the side. And you can't see the dirt from that perspective, so it all looks perfectly green, even if there's actually no difference. Our perspective is what makes the difference. So the message of this sermon might be not to envy anyone else, because if you knew the whole story, you'd see that their life is just as challenging as yours. But that's not the message of this sermon, because that's just another form of comparison. I look for the failures and flaws in others in order to justify that I'm doing okay. Yeah, he's ripped, but he's probably taking steroids. Yeah, she's skinny, but she probably has an eating disorder. Yeah, he's successful, but he's probably terrible at relationships. Yeah, she's rich or popular, but she's probably super self-centered. That kind of mean-spirited bitterness is just another evil product of our constant comparison. Another reason that's not the right approach is that it's often untrue. Occasionally, when I get to know famous pastors, I discover that they're actually hypocrites or jerks. But Tim Keller and Andy Stanley, they really are incredible men. They're not perfect, I'm sure, but the truth is, they're just more gifted than I am in many respects. If I need to measure up, I won't make it. Friends, though we do it so often, comparison is a harmful habit that will not lead us to the genuine joy that Jesus wants to give us. God offers a different solution. Those of you who've known me for a long time know that one of my favorite psalms is Psalm 16, because God used it to change my life. Psalm 16 was written while David was hiding in a cave from King Saul, who was trying to kill him. David had been told years earlier that he would be king one day, but instead, Saul was sitting on the throne. Saul was living the life that David should have had, and David had had it. He was outraged and angry and envious of Saul's position. We all have moments like that. Maybe others are getting promoted over you, or you can't get pregnant. Your friends disappointed you, your family's falling apart, your finances are depleted, your dreams are dashed, and you feel defeated. Why is it so easy for other people? It's so difficult for me. That's how David felt. But then he stops concentrating on Saul long enough to look at God, which is when he remembers the truth that changes his perspective. The boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance. David was complaining about what he didn't have, but missing the beauty and blessing of what he did. The boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance. I love that line because it rescues me from envy and it leads me to life. Let me explain. Using the metaphor of a yard marked out with stone walls, which were everywhere in David's day, he acknowledges in this verse that likewise there are limits on my life. So there are things I cannot do and cannot be. I'm only so smart, so strong, so interesting, so good with my hands or math or languages. I was created by God, but I was created with limits. I am what God made me to be. Other people have different limits. Maybe their yard is larger or smaller. Maybe it has more rocks or fewer, more or less water. That is the field that God gave them. Which is to say, some people are smarter or less smart than I am. Some people have more challenges or fewer, more blessings or fewer. But we all have limits. Most people hate limits, especially the kind of people who end up in Boston. It's easy to look over the metaphorical fence at your neighbor's yard where the grass seems greener, the plot looks bigger, the soil less rocky, or the water more plentiful. No matter what we've been given, we want more. I want more time, more friends, more opportunities, more money, more respect at work, more attention from others, more intimacy with my spouse, more potential spouses to choose from, more opportunities for my kids. No matter how much we have, we always want more. When John D. Rockefeller, the world's richest man, was asked, "How much money is enough?" he answered famously, "Just a little bit more." But this psalm reminds me that I have limits. God can do anything, but I'm not God. And he set limits on what I can do, experience, possess, or achieve. We see this from the first pages of Scripture. After forming the earth, the Lord declares it and us good. He places people in the lush Garden of Eden where they have everything they could ever want. Well, maybe not everything. Right in the middle of the garden, God plants a beautiful tree from which Adam and Eve may not eat. You'd think that if God didn't want them to eat the fruit, he might have made it less desirable, like a durian tree. Durian looks terrifying and smells so gross, it's called the puke fruit. Well, I think that could have kept Adam and Eve at bay. Or God could have placed it in a less conspicuous place, like on the side of an unscalable cliff. Good luck getting that fruit. God could do anything. He could have made the tree invisible or planted it 200 feet in the air so that it levitated above them out of reach. But the Lord planted it right in the middle of the garden, where they had to walk by it every day as a reminder that there are limits to what we can do, possess, experience, or achieve on this side of eternity. God did this not to be mean, but as a gift, to remind them to be content with the good things they have rather than always demanding the things that they don't. There's a limit to how many friends I can have, how well we'll understand each other, and how much they'll care. There's a limit to how much money I can make, how much I can buy, how many dreams I can achieve, how many skills I can possess, how many people I can please, how many programs I can drive my kids to, how much I can eat, how much I can drink, how far I can run, how little I can sleep. There are limits to how many people I can help, how many churches I can plant, or how much of a difference I can make. I can protest against those limits, always pushing against them, hoping to gain a few more feet because the grass looks greener on the other side of that wall in my neighbor's yard. I want the car or career or family or vacation or popularity that he has. The first lesson here is that God gave me limits. He set boundaries around my life that I can't do much about. But the second lesson is that God caused those boundary lines to fall in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance. The landowner in Jesus' parable reminds the worked up workers that while they suddenly wanted more, he had paid them everything he promised. Likewise, David realizes that while we all have limits, inside those boundaries are all we need for love, joy, peace, and contentment. God's given each of us different things, different lives, different opportunities, different abilities and personalities, different struggles and different callings. But true joy can be found in each of them. We have everything we need. So I can spend all my time looking over the fence to see what my neighbor has received in comparison to what I've been given and evaluate which I like better, which will lead to misery and division either way. Or I can look for the gifts that God has hidden in the field I'm actually in. This is the pathway to joy. It's called contentment. Being grateful for the good things God has given you rather than constantly demanding something else. The men in Jesus' parable were very content with the wages they were promised. In fact, they were overjoyed to be working at all until they started seeing what others had. And suddenly the good thing they were given didn't seem so good anymore. We're just like that. We always want more and more and more. We think we need those things to be happy. But people who are popular, successful, skinny, tall, or whatever you want to be, aren't necessarily happier. And beyond $75,000, study after study confirms that richer people aren't either. That's not what gives us joy. Paul warns rich people who are making themselves miserable by always wanting more, that in fact, godliness with contentment is itself great wealth. On the measures that actually matter, there's nobody poorer than the person who has nothing but money. So I don't need to own everything that my neighbor owns. I don't need to have all his abilities, her good looks, his opportunities, her intelligence, his marriage, her metabolism, his wealth, her popularity, his job, her resume, his family, her quick wit, because the boundary lines have fallen for me in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance. God hasn't given me everything, but he's given me everything I need for a full life and true joy. But the only way I'll find it is if I look in the field I have rather than the greener looking one on the other side of the fence. That's where God is. Not over there, somewhere that you never seem to reach. You'll find Jesus right here in the life you have if you look there. The calling the Lord gives each of us is not to have the biggest field or even the most fruit, but to find God in the field I'm in. And be faithful to be as fruitful as we can be there. He knows my limits, so God will never ask me why I wasn't Andy Stanley. He'll ask me why I wasn't willing to be me. So many of us experience needless anger, bitterness, insecurity, and stress because we're trying to live and spend beyond our limits, rather than finding God's presence and calling within them that would lead to joy. That is the way of this world and the goal of most advertisers. But there's another way. So this Lenten season, I invite you to trade comparison for contentment. So here are a few harmful habits you might want to unlearn this Lent. Perhaps unlearn mindless scrolling of social media when you're bored or before bed, because rather than relax us, it inspires judging and insecurity. You're looking for something, connection, excitement, life, but you won't find it there. It's like trying to satisfy your thirst by drinking salt water. It only makes you thirstier. So consider fasting from social media during Lent. Or perhaps deciding only to use it when you have a specific goal, like reaching out to one particular friend or a specific time limit. If so many studies confirm that it makes us miserable, then why would we even want to use it? Commit to no more mindless scrolling. In its place, there are a few new habits you could learn that might lead to healing. Begin by making gratitude a practice. At dinner every night, our family goes around the table to share one thing that we're thankful for. Many other people keep a gratitude journal. You know, one Lent, I wrote down three things I was thankful for each day, but never repeating anything I'd written before. Initially, it was easy. But after a week, it became really hard because I'd said everything already. But as I pushed through that, it became easy again, because my eyes were open to notice so many wonderful things God had given or done for me that I'd been taking for granted. Limiting myself to three each day became the real challenge. Another new habit could be to notice when you envy someone, whether it's your best friend or billionaire Jeff Bezos, and instead of resenting them for having something that you don't, pray to give God thanks for blessing them that way. That could be like those day laborers thanking the landowner for being so generous to the ones who came late but still needed to eat. Envy is always evidence of our lack of love for others. Just like a cough is a sign of an underlying sickness, because we never envy those we love. When my children receive a blessing or achieve something, I never feel envy. I feel joy. Praying to give thanks for those who have things I envy can help me enjoy that gift in them rather than resenting that I don't have it. As for me, the boundary lines have fallen in pleasant places. Surely I have a delightful inheritance. I don't need what they have. God has given me Himself and so much more, and it's enough for joy. Being grateful for the good things God has given me makes it much harder to be resentful about the things He didn't. As we close, I want to give you time to ask God if there's a habit you might want to commit to learning or unlearning this Lent. Perhaps it will relate to comparison and contentment, or perhaps God is nudging you to tackle something else. Welcome to the Lenten School of Unlearning, so that you might find even fuller life.